Today is Thursday, August 3rd, 2006. My name is Sandy Fehler, and I am an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Susan Coppersmith, Professor of Physics and current chair of the Physics Department in Letters and Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning.
Hi.
We're going to start with some questions about your early life. When you were born, where you were born, if you would talk about your parents, if you have any siblings, where you went to elementary school, high school, were there any people that influenced you in your future education, and anything else that you want to tell us about growing up.
Okay, great. So I was born and raised in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and famous for floods, and not much there. So let's see, my childhood, I was probably fairly uneventful. There are a couple things. One was, I guess I was a nerdy kid, and so socially I didn't fit in very well. And my mother also had emotional problems, and when you're a kid, anything unusual about your family is difficult. And for whatever reason, I have a brother and a sister, but my mother disliked me the most, and so that was sort of an issue. But I got along well with my father, and there was no major problems. In retrospect, though, at the time I was pretty miserable.
What did your father do?
He was a lawyer. My brother is now a lawyer, and my sister actually had more difficulty. She was younger, and my mother basically sort of deteriorated. Her first episode, she was a manic depressive, and her first episode was when I was 8. So my sister is about 6, and she was my mother's favorite, and so it was very difficult for her. And then basically, around the time I hit about 10th grade, so what, that makes me about 15 or so, my mother basically was non-functional. So it was sort of difficult for my sister. And so eventually, I guess she got, and my father was in the state legislature, which meant he was away half the week. And so I guess when I was in high school, there was sort of trying to deal with my sister, and eventually she got sent to a boarding school because it was sort of an impossible situation.
Did you go to public school?
Yeah, so we went to high school in suburban Johnstown. I know that's hard to believe it exists, but yeah. But anyway, it was sort of pretty lousy socially, so I was very much looking forward to go to college, and I went to MIT, and the reason was I sort of fell against a lot of place, and I had interest in science, and so I felt like socially I would fit in better.
Did you have good teachers in high school?
No. It was really sort of a social motivation, but I you know, was somehow always, school was very easy, and it was sort of bad because I sort of hung out with these kids who were, you know, again, there was a social misfit group, and many kids in the social misfit group were not very good students, and so I would be skipping school with a social misfit friend, and then, you know, the friend would get in trouble, and I wouldn't get in trouble because it was sort of targeted. The trouble of, you know, missing school without permission was sort of targeted on the bad students. That made it difficult also. Anyway, but there you are. So anyway, that's how I ended up at MIT, was basically I was interested in science, and again, I'd had sort of a difficult time socially. So
was it what you expected at MIT?
Yeah, I liked MIT, and they were in sort of, in retrospect, I can appreciate it more. And you know, and there were things that weren't perfect about it. Obviously, any school has problems, but I really enjoyed it there, and there was a lot of opportunity, and socially I fit in a lot better. And so it is one of those times where you say, well, so I think that was an example which has come up in my life many times, of you're in a place and you're miserable and everybody hates you, and you go to a different place, and you think you're the same person, but the response that everybody has to you is completely different. And that, I think, was the first time that happened to me. And I find it's happened to me many times, and I think that that's sort of an interesting thing to have that, where just there's this bad karma thing that happens, and you're in a situation where you're miserable and everybody hates you, and then you just go somewhere else and it all goes away. Okay, so that was my early life. So
we'll talk a little bit about MIT.
Okay.
What was it like there? Was it as hard as
yeah, it was hard, but you know, I think you had to work hard, and you know, but there was like a lot of opportunity there, and you know, when people had said it's like really competitive, but you know, I didn't find it, you know, cutthroat in any way. I mean, you know, people worked hard, but it wasn't vicious or nasty. Mm-hmm. No, I wasn't a pre-med, but even so, I mean, you know, so I liked, you know, I look back on it and I say that, you know, it was a good school, and I learned a lot. And again, sort of the social aspect of life was much better for mm-hmm. me there. And so what happened was, I guess I went there, and it was sort of interesting when I was applying to colleges. I remember, I only have dim recollections because I'm aging rapidly, but I remember I wrote many, or maybe not many, but several different essays about what you wanted to do. Because, well, I thought I wanted to do brain science, or maybe I wanted to do chemistry, or maybe, you know. And so I knew I was interested in science, but I hadn't actually settled on a topic. Mm-hmm. And that was just sort of my personality, that I would actually like go to the trouble of writing a different essay every time I changed my mind. So I don't even remember which one I told MIT I was interested in doing. But there you are. When I went there, though, I wasn't clear on what area. And part of it was like in Johnstown. I went to the school called Westmont Hilltop High School, which is, you know, had 200 students in the graduating class, 219 or something like that. And it was, you know, it wasn't a particularly good school. Which, when I got to MIT, was an issue because, you know, a lot of kids went to, like, Bronx Science or Stuyvesant, and, you know, and we were taking freshman physics, and I had, like, not a clue about what was going on, and I found it very difficult because I just didn't have the mindset. And then I'd be having these problems and struggling, whatever, and then they'd say, oh, I did that last year. They'd whip out their notes from high school, and I felt, you know, very sort of underprepared. But
how'd you get through it?
Well, it was weird because the thing about physics, which was interesting, was I was taking this physics, and they have various brands of physics, and they had this thing called physics for, well, they didn't call it, but we called it physics for masochists, which was the advanced physics. And I was doing it, and I was just like completely clueless, but then there was like, I'm struggling and working really hard and not really getting it, and I took the first exam, I got a 42, which is like not very good. And then I was like sitting in the section, and I still remember the problem, which was there was a raindrop falling from the sky, and so there's gravity, but then also there's rain, and there's mass accumulating, and so the mass is going up, and so you gotta figure out like what's the terminal, and there's friction, and the friction depends on the radius, and so you gotta sort of say, oh, here's friction, force pushing it up, and there's gravity pushing it down, but then the mass is changing, and then you had to write a differential equation for the motion, and then find the terminal velocity. Actually, you didn't need the differential equation, but you didn't need to solve the differential equation, just to find terminal velocity. And it was like, oh, and after that, I had absolutely no problem, and I did, you know, it was just this thing where it was very interesting for me, where I went from like, you know, they tell you draw a force diagram, and you know, and I was like trying to do things and not understanding any of it, to absolutely no problem after that. I mean, it really was like the light bulb went on,
sure.
And I understood what was supposed to happen.
Huh.
And that was sort of cool. This thing that, you know, once you get it, and you understand what's happening, it's all completely clear. And so, I mean, that was sort of why, one of the reasons I think I ended up in physics, because it really was just like, you know, there's this way of thinking about it which had this sort of internal consistency to it, and there is a logic to it, and like once you understood the logic, you could apply it to like all these things, and you know, because Newton's law is good for so many things, you know, and you know, like once you got it on that one problem, every other problem you could solve. And so that for me was sort of a big deal, and sure. I'm not sure it would have made that much difference if I'd done it in high school or whatever, but you know, like once you've got it, then you've got it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, so that was the thing. So MIT, there were various issues, but the thing at MIT was, you know, I remember I was in a class and, well, there were a couple things that were sort of funny. So it turned out that my freshman advisor was the chair of the math department. And I'm like, oh, okay, and so not knowing that this was unusual. And so he says, are you related to Don Coppersmith? And I said, well, no. Okay. And every time I took a math course, the person would say, teacher would say, not every time, but for a few years, mm-hmm. are you related to Don Coppersmith? And I'd say, no. And then finally, I'm like, who's this guy, you know? And it turns out that he was at MIT. He was from a different small town in Pennsylvania, actually an even smaller town in Pennsylvania. No relation, but he went to MIT and he won the Putnam Prize, which is this national competition in mathematics, 4 years in a row. He's the only person in history, as far as I know, who's won the Putnam Prize 4 years in a row. And so then here comes this other person, small town from Pennsylvania, same last name, not too common, and they just sort of assume I must be related, but like I wasn't, but never mind, okay. So that was sort of interesting, but, and then it turns out that in the meantime, he's a mathematician, but he's worked on fields that are related to fields that I've worked on.
And so have you met him?
I met him. Actually, I met him in college. Someone knew him. Because when you win the Putnam Prize, you get a fellowship to Harvard, and there was some guy who knew him. And so he said, oh, here, you should meet him. So I actually met him once. I think I've only met him the one time. But I know his work, and people say, oh, I see you did X, Y, and Z. And it's like, no, that's this other guy. And the only upshot of it that was sort of interesting was that many, many years later, my sister opened up a restaurant in Philadelphia, and she wanted to call it Coppersmiths of Johnstown. And it turns out that in Pennsylvania, you know, you have to register business names. And it turned out there was a furniture store in Emporia, Pennsylvania called Coppersmiths. And she's like, there's a store named Coppersmiths, and you know, whatever. And so she says, get permission to use the name. And again, Emporia is like in northwestern Pennsylvania, and this she was in Philadelphia. She says, but I have to call him up to get permission. I said, when you call him, ask him if he knows Don Coppersmith. And sure enough, it was Don Coppersmith's uncle. You know? So anyway, she got the permission. It was fine. But anyway, it's a small world. So that was the thing. So the thing about MIT, though, is I was taking this math course, and again, some of the people knew from the name sort of thought maybe I was okay. But this guy was like, every time I'd ask a question, he's just like, what a stupid question or whatever. And actually, the students were pretty good, where they, you know, like I was there and I would ask a question, he'd say, well, that's a stupid question. And there was someone else in the class who said, well, actually, I have the same question.
Oh, that's nice.
which was nice. And, right. And you know, and again, and but the thing about it was, at MIT, it was completely anonymous. So it would be this thing, you'd be in the class, they wouldn't know who you were, and you'd take the exam, I'd sign my initials, they wouldn't know I was a woman, and you just do what you did on the exam. And so I really felt that there was no problem in the sense that I just did what I did, I was judged on a fair basis, mm-hmm. basically because I had no idea who I was. Mm-hmm. And so that actually was sort of the big shock at graduate school when I ran into all sorts of problems because, you know, you're not anonymous when you're a graduate student. But as an undergraduate, I was in this, you know, big industrial, you know, people complained about MIT because it's big and industrial, whatever. But I loved it because I really felt, you know, it was this sort of platonic ideal of, you know, a system that you understood the system, you knew the criteria, it was sort of, you know, applied in a blind fashion and all very straightforward mm-hmm. in its impersonality. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was college. You know, and actually there were a few courses where they figured out who I was. But in general, what would happen is that you know, it would be after you took an exam. If you did well on the exam, then you had credibility. It was just that if they just looked at you and saw you were a girl, they would assume you're stupid, but you could overcome that. And so that actually was the other difficulty, like later on when I was a graduate student, was, you know, this thing where I'd say, well, I'll just do an exam, I'll do well, they'll believe that I'm not an idiot. And I found later that didn't work. You know, but as an undergraduate, it worked perfectly. You know, they had these things, and if you did well in the exam, they assumed that you were a good student, and, you know, okay. Mm-hmm. So looking back on it, sort of undergraduate school was sort of, you know, a very poor preparation for life because, mm-hmm. you know, it was all very straightforward, and
yeah,
there weren't any difficult.
Sort of fair.
Okay, so let's see, that's my getting to that. So that's my...
All right, well then how did I end up in physics?
So this was in the early 70s, and so I started college in 1974. And this was right after the oil crisis, the Arab oil embargo, whatever, and the hot field to be in was chemical engineering because of oil, you know, and so, and chemistry sort of also being close to chemical engineering, like these are the majors where there are lots of jobs. And this was during the period when there were no jobs in physics. Because as you probably know, what happened was there was this huge growth in physics in the 60s, and then around 1970, the whole thing collapsed, and during the 70s, there were like no jobs in physics. And so, you know, so sort of the default was I was gonna do chemistry. And so, you know, so I took chemistry, and I took like the big chemistry course, and I was working in a chemistry lab, and so I took sort of organic one, where it wasn't called organic at that point, it was called intro to something, but it was sort of along the lines of organic, and, you know, one of the big mainline chemistry courses, and, you know, sort of, anyway, and so through some long story, I did well in that course, and because I did well enough, and one of the TAs from the TA from that course was working for some guy, I ended up getting a job in a lab. And turns out I have no aptitude for chemistry. I have no aptitude for lab work. I learned that in physics also later. So let's put it this way: if I do have aptitude, it's very well hidden from me. So. Anyway, so I was doing chemistry, and then I was like taking the third semester. So I took the first semester, second semester, you know, and then the third semester was just, it seemed like, it was like a mop-up operation. You know, it was like just all these facts, and it didn't have, I mean, you know, and again, the thing about physics, which I really liked, was this idea that you'd have like one idea. I mean, well, much later, I was like in something, and I was sort of talking about this, and there's this famous guy who was there, and I was sort of talking about this kind of, you know, why I liked it, and he sort of said, well, yes, it's a key that opens a very heavy door, was his analog. Yeah, again, just as I know, there'd be like the set of ideas that were very, that seemed very simple or, you know, easy to say, whatever, and you could apply them without more facts to so many situations. And again, in chemistry, it just seemed there, it was just more facts. And now, of course, you find out that, you know, when you're doing research, you don't have that key to the very heavy door, and you're trying to find the key to the heavy door, so you end up, you're sort of, you know, in the morass of facts, and, you know, but this idea that that's your aspiration of, you know, finding that simple thing that sort of opens up a whole lot of, you know, insight into so many situations. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the thing that I thought was really neat about physics. But on the other hand, there was this issue about employment. So anyway, so it turns out I was friends with this guy who, you know, he was my lab partner, but I was a freshman, but when we were sophomore, we were lab partner, but you know, we did homework, so whatever, good friends with this guy, whatever, and I said, you know, I don't know what to do. And so what I did at the beginning was I was going to double major in chemistry and physics, and it was just sort of clear that wasn't going to work, you know, that it was just too heavy a load, and I just didn't want to do it. And, You know, because there's always this thing of, you know, if you take too heavy a load, then you don't do a good job, and, you know, yeah. So I said, well, I really want to pick one. I really don't want a double major. So I was deciding between chemistry and physics, and I said, well, you know, I really like physics, but on the other hand, I'm not sure I'll ever get a job, and if I go into chemistry, then, you know I'll be able to get a job. And so this guy says to me, he says, well, you know, my dad really liked math. And so he really enjoyed it, and so he decided to get a PhD in math. And he really enjoyed that. And when he finished, he didn't get a job in math. He said, but he got into designing shopping centers, and we have $20 million now. I said, sounds good to me. And so I said, well, yeah, but just this idea that something will turn up. Okay, you know, so anyway, so I ended up that's how I decided to be a physics major. And so then what happened was I had this sort of target of, oh, I wanted to learn about general relativity. But it turns out that by the time you take all the prerequisites for general relativity, you don't learn it until you're in graduate school. So that's how I had to go to graduate school, whatever. So anyway, but that was how I ended up in physics. And then I had various, I was very lucky because I got summer jobs starting after my sophomore year at Bell Labs. And so that had a big influence, I think, in sort of turning me towards condensed matter, because the summer jobs were in, well, actually the first one was in atomic physics.
Does Bell Lab, do they look for MIT students to work for them in the summer? Or
well, this was all very sad because this was way back in the good old days. So Bell Labs had a wonderful program that mm-hmm. targeted underrepresented groups. And actually, if you're interested in this sort of thing, there's a guy named Henry Eskowitz who I believe was at City College, whatever, but he was involved in a study of this program. And there was a summer research program, which was for undergraduates, but then they also had a graduate fellowship program, and their one for women was called Graduate Research Program for Women. And then there was one for minorities called the initials were CRFP, and the FP are Fellows Program. I don't know what the C and the R, though.
Mm-hmm.
But that program had, like, supported, at one point, they had supported half of all of the black science PhDs in the country. Some hard science. It was an amazing percentage of all of the people who had gotten PhDs had been supported. I mean, the women, it wasn't quite so, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. The program was great, and they have a, you know, fabulous track record if you look who was funded by that program, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of really well-known people were, and, you know, I could talk for myself, and for myself, I never would have gotten a PhD if I hadn't been associated with that program.
Mm-hmm.
But the one for blacks was even more amazing in terms of the record.
Mm.
Anyway, so, but the summer research program was like a summer program, and it's like less, you know, what's happened is that Bell Labs is fallen on hard times, and you know, it's all very sad. But I would say that this thing of being able to do summer research now, like the NSF is pushing very hard on it. And there's like, and, you know, and there are like a billion summer research programs. And it's not, in terms of being able to do summer research, the fact that they're not as active is not as serious a problem, because you know, there's just so much summer research going on in the world these days because the NSF pushes so hard on it. But when I was an undergraduate, they didn't have this university-based stuff, and I remember, you could try to find someone to hire you in a lab at MIT, and like after my freshman year, I just, you know, went around from lab to lab, and I, you know, it took me like 20 labs till I found a place.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, someone told me about this thing at Bell, and I applied there. I got in after my sophomore year. But then after my junior year, what happened was I thought I could only do it once. And so I was looking around, and you know, and the only thing I found, I mean, in the end, I was able to go back to Bell, which I didn't know this, and that was like a long story about that, which I probably won't tell you because I have so many stories and it's, you know, not so relevant. What happened was that I was looking around, the thing I found was like a Kodak where they wanted to test photographic plates, and so the idea was that they were going to hire a student to count the stars that came out, you know, take an astronomical picture, and someone had to count the stars. You know, and it was just like, there just wasn't that much in those days. And so the fact that I was able to get these jobs, you know, that I was able to get hired by Bell and do, really interesting things,
mm-hmm.
you know, had a big impact. And so that was actually how I ended up in condensed matter. But then also what happened was I didn't have any real lab experience, but then I worked in the lab, and there was always this thing where I felt very uncomfortable at the beginning and said, oh, but you know, when you get as you do it, you'll get more comfortable, whatever. And so I had done sort of two summers in the lab, and then I had done the year-long lab course at MIT, and at the end I still didn't feel comfortable. You know, I just never got comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I started a small fire in one lab, but it was very small. And But I just never felt comfortable, and so, you know, that's my gravitation towards theory was more because of a, you know, sort of constant sense of incompetence in lab, as opposed to, you know, any sort of disdain.
Okay. So how did you get to grad school?
So I was at MIT and whatever, and so I applied to grad school. And before I went to grad school, I went to England for a year on a Churchill scholarship, which is 1 year at Cambridge, at this place called Churchill College. And actually, we should do more of it here. I mean, Wisconsin is one of the schools that is authorized to nominate people to be Churchill scholars, and it has to be in the sciences, but mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing. It's, 1 year. And so what happened was I applied to grad schools, and I was a very good-looking applicant because I had, all A's at MIT, and I had very high standardized test scores, which I found out in the meantime was sort of unusual for female students. So, and I had, I had letters, I had papers, I had a paper. And, the paper, I wasn't like the prime mover, but, they put me on a paper because I had, during the second summer I worked, I had, done all sorts of stuff. And actually, even though I almost did the guy's lab on fire, I also saved his lab at some other point where he had sort of, it was one of these things where he had said, he had some diffusion pump running, and he said, well, here's the roughing pump, and here's the diffusion pump, and if you ever see that the diffusion pump is on and the roughing pump is off, that can blow the whole pump system, and that's, you have to let me know. And so the guy I was working for went on vacation, and it happened that I went into the lab, and there had been a power failure, and the diffusion pump was on, and the roughing pump was off. And so he had told me, this is not rocket science, but he had told me, you have to, whatever. And he was on vacation, but had left a number. And so I called him on vacation, and I said, the roughing pump is off, and the diffusion pump is on. What do I do? And so he said, okay. And he walked me through, turning off the thing. And then he had, there were the other people who would be working in the lab in the morning, and they could turn back on. But he said, wait, here, you can turn it off. So anyway, and so he was, so even though at some later point I set the lab, it was a contained fire or whatever, but there's smoke coming out and shit like this, and he's like, is everything okay? And I'm like, everything's okay. And he like walks out, and I'm like, wow, but he said, but look, this other time when there was a problem, you told me there was a problem, and so therefore when you told me there wasn't a problem, I decided to believe you. So, okay, but nonetheless, there you are. So. Anyway, so I had a great recommendation letter from this guy because I saved his lab, and then, it's, at MIT I did well in undergraduate, so I had this, so I got in everywhere. And so what happened, though, and at the time I thought I was going to go to Berkeley, but Berkeley would not defer for a year. And I also got into Cornell, and the people at Bell were very high on Cornell, because that was sort of, right after superfluid helium-3 and the renormalization group, and Cornell was absolutely the center of condensed matter physics, except for Bell Labs, of course. Mm-hmm. You couldn't Bell Labs thing. But probably, it was a great, you look and you say that, it was a very exciting time at Cornell, and so I had applied to Cornell. And then I went, and actually with this friend whose father did the shopping centers, we went and visited, and it was like May, and it was like, you know how it is like in Madison, everyone's like, there's just one of these gorgeous days. I mean, it's just beautiful weather, and they were really nice and whatever, and they said, oh, you don't have to reapply, we'll just hold it open, and you can come in a year, and again, everyone from Bell said, look, this is the best place to be, and I went to Berkeley, and it was sort of, they were like, well, you have to reapply, and then they said, well, and in condensed matter theory, they sort of had not very many people, and they did a particular brand of stuff that was very sort of computer-oriented. I wasn't sure I wanted to do that. And so I said, oh, okay, and so I decided to go to Cornell. So that's how I ended up at graduate school, at Cornell, mm-hmm. for graduate school. And then I got there, and it was horrible. I mean, it was just one of these bad karma things where, couldn't get an advisor, and then.
Now, why do you think that was? Was it the fact that you were a woman, or what?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that. Well, I'm obnoxious. I mean, it's this thing where I had an expectation,
sure.
that I was going to be treated as a star. Mm-hmm. Okay. But part of that is because I had a fellowship, and with the benefit of hindsight, and knowing what it's like to have a student come to you who has a fellowship and is free, yeah, you do. You're like, yeah, you know. But that didn't happen to me. So there's like one guy I remember. I said, well, I'd like to work. You know, and I did okay. You know, I got A's. I got A minuses in a couple classes. But, you know, I got A's in my classes and whatever. And I, you know, but no, they just didn't like women students. It was just, you know, it was an atmosphere of hate. And so, and this was the first year when they had a reasonable number of women students. And you know, and basically what happens, every single one of them, and you could talk to any of them, and everyone will have a story. Mm-hmm. Because there are a few people in the department who are just actively anti-women in science, and then, you know, they're there, they're tenured, whatever, and then everybody's just sort of coming to some accommodation, and, you know, and it was just a bad scene.
No women on the faculty?
No. No. So, you know, in the meantime, things, you know, there are people at Cornell who were actively made things better and stuff like that. But at the time I was there, it was just sort of a nightmare. And again, after MIT, where, you know, I said, at the beginning, you know, people would, you know, but you take Sam, they'd say you're reasonable, you know, and it didn't matter what I knew. No one thought I was reasonable. No one took me on. So this one guy, it's like, well, I'm interested in working with you. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have any money. Oh, that's okay, I have a fellowship. Oh, I don't have any time either. And now, with the benefit of hindsight, I realized that it really was unbelievable. Yeah. And so, I don't want to get into detail. It was just sort of horrendous. So in the end, I'm not going to get into all the stories. In the end, what happened was I had this fellowship from Bell. This graduate research program for women was a fellowship that paid till I finished. I mean, it was a fabulous fellowship. Okay. And so I said, look, I got to get out of here. And they said, well, but no, you might lose your fellowship. I said, well, I may lose my fellowship, but I got to get out of here. And at that time, the program hadn't been going that long, and no one had actually graduated, and so we slimed some deal where I could do my thesis at Bell, okay? And I actually was working for the son of a guy who was on the faculty at Cornell, and it was all very incestuous, and it sort of led from your stories, but it doesn't matter. But once I got to Bell, within like sort of 3-4 months, I mean, this guy at Bell had sort of had a thesis project in mind, but actually, after 3 or 4 months, I said, well, you know, I found something, my own project. I said, you know, I'd like to do this. He said, okay. I did it. And like 2 years later, couldn't get, you know. So there I am, like at Cornell, just flailing around, miserable, can't get anywhere, no accomplishments, not doing anything, completely miserable. I moved to Bell, and absolutely no problem. And, you know, just go, do, get a PhD. And, you know, when I didn't do super great, you know, getting postdocs and things like that, partly because, you know, so, well, you know, they said, you know, that she's, you know, emotionally unstable, and having a mother who ended up committing suicide because it was, you know, it was, but, you know, I didn't sort of publicize that, but, you know, it was this thing of, you know, in the sense of, you know, what they're willing to say about you to be consistent with their world.
You mean Cornell said you were?
Yeah. No, they said that, you know, that again, this idea that somehow it was all my fault that I was having problems. And absolutely blaming the victim. And again, it was that because I had serious emotional problems and I needed psychiatric help was the reason that this happened. And so what's interesting, and then again, I leave and everything's fine. I just go, oh, she must have gotten help for her psychiatric problems. And, you know, so of course I have an incredible amount of resentment towards that. Yeah. But what to be said. Anyway, but then the, you know, various things. And so what happened was, and there was a certain amount of doing postdocs and things, and I stayed in the New York area because my husband was going to medical school by that time.
And now, when did you meet your husband?
Oh, I met him in England. So we got married while I was in graduate school.
Okay.
And so then by that time he was in med school. And he did an MD PhD, which is 7 years. And so, you know, so a lot of the job thing I was trying to coordinate with him. Mm-hmm. And so eventually I did a postdoc at Brookhaven National Lab, which is on Long Island. And then I got a job as a postdoc at Bell. And there's a long story involved there, but I did 1 year, and then I did a year at Princeton visiting, and then I went back to Bell. And again, this is to stay in step with him, because it turned out, you know, sometimes you can finish in 6 years, and sometimes it's seven, and if it had been six, I had one plan, but then when it turned out it was clear it was going to be seven, I had to add another year, and yeah, anyway. But I got on the staff at Bell, and so I was there for 8 years. And then, and that was fun, but there was this issue where you could tell that they were regulated monopoly for a long time, and then it became deregulated, and then, you know, whatever. And then by the early 90s, it was clear that, you know, this place was not going to be stable. I was in my early 30s, and so this question of, you know, is it going to be stable on the time scale you require? And so if you're saying, well, when's it, you know, is this shit going to hit the fan or whatever? If you get into, like, the near term, you know, who knows? But if you get into, well, is it going to be around for 30 years? I mean, even in in the early 90s, it was completely obvious that it wasn't going to be stable for 30 years. And then if it was not going to be stable for 30 years, then you're like, well, I got to sort of then maximize, you know, I got to jump, and then the trick is to jump at the best moment and get the best deal you can at a time. Yeah, just get the best deal you can. If you wait too long, you're not assailable. But on the other hand, if you're building your reputation, you're becoming more saleable, but as you age, you become less saleable, and you gotta find the right time. So anyway, so in sort of 93, I was like very serious, and I said, I'm gonna get a job. And then through some very long story that I don't think is so relevant, I was very lucky, though I like to think, of course, I deserved it all, very lucky, and I got a job at University of Chicago, tenure job, full professor. And so, but then my husband was in his situation, and it was just one of these things that he also got a job in the area, but in the end, his job fell through, but I went to Chicago, because actually Chicago was my dream job. I was just so excited to get it. It was wonderful, whatever. Okay. And so I was there for 6 years. And I loved it. But then what happened was my husband was still in New York because this job he had in the area fell through. And then we had a kid. And then dealing with a baby when your husband's away half the week. And he didn't, you know, it was just, my job was like the best job I could hope for ever in the world. But my life sucked. and so then what happened was that he got offered a faculty job at the medical school here. And so then he says, oh yes, but I've got this wife. Okay. And actually they sort, you know, some people here knew me. And when I had looked to leave Bell in 93, I had written and no one had ever gotten back to me, which in retrospect, you know, is sort of obvious because whatever. Mind. Anyway, so, but they sort of knew me and whatever. But mostly, I mean, since I came from Chicago and I had the certification of being good enough for Chicago, you know, of course they're going to hire me. So, you know, so I got a job here and that's how I ended up here. And this is just one of these things where this thing of the trade-off. I mean, you know, just sort of the trade-off on the personal life. It just never was going to get fixed. Mm-hmm. And even though the department here is not as good, it's just having all of the stuff fixed on the personal side. I mean, there just wasn't any question that I was going to take the job.
Now, when was that?
2001.
Okay,
2001.
What did you know? You said you knew some people here. What did you know about the department? You know it wasn't as good as Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, in my field, I mean, so the thing is, in my field, Chicago is, you know, there's like this little sub-area that I'm in, and Chicago is sort of a big center for it. And I fit in really well because there are sort of these different subgroups and condensed matter, and I sort of was in between, and so I could talk to everybody, and I got along personally with the people, and so it was one of those. And here I sort of knew some of the people from Aspen, because like the Durans are very active in Aspen, and so they knew me there because I was sort of went there fairly regularly, and so they knew me or of me or, you know, from that. And trying to think if there was anyone else I knew before I came. I knew Bob Joint a little. But mostly, I think it was just, you know, one of these reputation things. That, you know, there was no way that they could say I wasn't qualified for a job.
Right.
They're, you know, and then they're playing ball with the med school. And at the time, the physics department had an offer out to someone, and they were trying to get the med school to play ball with the physics department.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, it was just, you know, all the things were such that there wasn't going to be any problem.
Right.
But then I came, and it was pretty bad. And now, with the benefit of, you know, a little bit of perspective, I can sort of see that, you know, there are just a lot of things going on that had nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it was pretty bad. So, you know, I came, and no one gave a shit. I mean, this is this thing that you go to a place, and you know, whether they care about you. And nobody gave a shit about me. And it was sort of interesting. And my big problem, I'm a theorist, so I don't set up a lab, but, you know, I had set up computers and whatever. And in Chicago, there's computer support. And here, there's sort of like some guy who's supposed to do computer support, but it's not real, you know? It's at the end of like 6 months, my computers didn't work, and I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even print at this stage. And it was part of it, you know, because no one would lay out words in one syllable, like, you can have this, and not this, and we can do this, and not that. And like, no one's having, you know, and I was having problems, and they said, well, why don't you ask Do It for help? You know, and then I did it, and you know, after I don't do it, I'm like, well, they weren't going to help me. They, you know, I mean, at this level of, you know, Do It can do some things, but, you know, it was like, it was clear that, you know, when they tell me to talk to Do It for the problem that I had, they didn't want to solve my problem. They wanted me to shut up. You know, it was just clear, you know, and that was the thing where nobody gave a shit. And so it was sort of interesting. I came in, I walked into the chair. Reader was the chair. Reader's a very nice guy, but Reader is incapable of saying anything unpleasant. He's, unwilling to say no, or it can't be done, or it's wicked. You know, I went in, I said, I'm sorry, Don. And I called him Chicago. I said, look, I cannot function here. I may have to come back. Mm-hmm. Can I come back? Well, we don't know, but yeah. I mean, everybody liked me. It wasn't like they were mad at me. Right. You know, they knew, everyone knew why I left. It wasn't because I was unhappy. And they, you know, when I provided value to the institution.
Sure.
So, you know, so I went in for I'm sorry, I have to leave. Because what had happened was my computers weren't working. And I said, well, we're going to hire some guy to do computer support. So finally, after 6 months, I hire a guy. So I say to the guy, I need to get these things to work. And the guy says, it's not my job. I'm like, what do you mean it's not my job? And he said, well, you know, I talked to Professor Smith, and Professor Smith said that I'm not supposed to do support for individual faculty, computer support. So I call up Wesley, and, you know, I'm friends with Wesley now. You know, I call Professor Smith, and I say, Wesley, you know, I say, Professor Smith, I mean, I need to get my computers to work. Because you're new, we'll let him work on your computers. And then I'm thinking about this, and I'm like, well, what about when I'm not new? No one gives a shit if my computers work, and I'm not new, and then I can't say that I'm new. And I'm saying, I'm sorry, I have to leave. If I cannot get computer support, I have to go. So Reader, finally, whatever, we got the computers working, and I calmed down a little bit. But, you know, it's fucking ridiculous. Excuse me. It's just ridiculous. And so what happened was, you know, there were just various, in this department is, I'm chair, but it's completely non-functional. And now, in retrospect, a lot of that is because it's still complete, it's amazing. It's completely traumatized still by the Sterling Hall bombing. I mean, it's amazing.
Oh, really?
And this came up because when we moved into the new building, I mean, this, I'll just put this here, you know. So Chancellor Wiley comes in because, you know, he has his PhD from the physics department.
Yeah.
Okay, and so he came in for the dedication of the new building. And he gets up and he says, well, you know, the Sterling Hall bombing, there was this guy named Robert Fosnock who was killed. I mean, it's this completely tragic story because what had happened was that, you know, He had finished his PhD, and he was working as a postdoc, and he had gotten a job, and he was leaving the next day. His wife and three kids were home, and he was there just finishing everything up. They were going to get in the car in the morning and drive to California, and that's when the bomb went off. I mean, you know, talk about tragedy.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Anyway. You know, and so anyway, so Wiley's there, and he said, you know, we really should have a plaque. And so it's like, great. I said, yes, we should have a plaque. So I'm the chair, and so I said, okay, he says, if you get the wording for a plaque, we'll do a plaque. So we have meetings and whatever, and so I go, and I did it mostly talking to people, whatever, but it turns out that basically, you know, there's just an incredible amount of ill will left over from that bombing, because there's this thing of, like, it seems, again, this is me, I came in 2001, mm-hmm. I don't know anything, I wasn't there, and people don't want to talk about it, obviously. But I think what it was that really is just this question of how culpable the people who set the bomb were. Okay, you know, who put the truck bomb on. Okay, did they mean to kill people? You know, and they said, you know, and the people said, well, they didn't mean to kill people. They did 3 in the morning because they didn't think anyone would be there. But, you know, but and so it goes from irresponsible to where there are murderers. Okay, mm-hmm. And then you get this, and then you can understand why these people who, like, individually seem perfectly nice and perfectly reasonable cannot stand each other.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and you could see where, you know, and there were, I wasn't here, but, you know, you just from here, you know, just there were faculty who were just, you know, whose entire research infrastructure was just completely devastated. And, mm-hmm. you know, and some of the guys never recovered. That was it. There was, I guess, one guy, Dexter, I mean, who never recovered. And then there was one of the nuclear guys, Krashauer, I think his name is, who left for a while, but then he came back, and I think Willie was sort of the hero, Willie Haberly, because, and again, all of this is like umpteenth hand, you know, but anyway, he was the guy who says we're rebuilding and whatever, and then eventually Crash Tower came back, and the group sort of started up again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but anyway, but just this ill will of, you know, and you could see where this would be a thing where, you know, and that just sort of explained a lot to me in terms of, you know, the dysfunctionality of the department, where there's just this thing that you could not discuss. Because people were just never going to agree. So there we were, and we're working on this plaque, you know, the wording of the plaque, and back and forth, and what do you say, and it was, you know. And then it was interesting, because there was a guy, you know, a young guy, he was a scientist over in plasma, and he, you know, and we were doing this, and he says, well, what about this wording? And, you know, and it was like, we could agree on that wording. So last September, we sent the thing up to Wiley, saying, here's the wording. You know, we don't get into, you know, it's this thing, and everybody, you know, and it was sort of traumatic, whatever, but... You know, we signed up to Wiley, and it's like a year almost. We still haven't heard back. And every few months, I say, and I don't know what the hell's going on with this damn plan and why we can't get it. And so finally, like, I called the chancellor's office, and I said, well, I've been sending this thing. We sent it 4 times, I think. Sent it 4 times to the chancellor's office, never got a thing. And I said, well, you know, I've been sending it to you, and we've never gotten a reply. Oh, no, we reply to all of our correspondence. I'm like, no, you don't. Yes, we do. Well, no, you don't. Yeah, and it's like, well, of course we do. Well, no, you don't. You get this big discussion. Anyway, so I don't know, but that's part of the dysfunctionality of the department. A lot of it is sort of arising.
Well, are there some retirements? Can you? Are you hiring newer people?
Yeah,
that
so that's
around?
Been my main agenda is sort of with the renewal, because we have had a lot of retirements, but it explains why, you know, somehow a lot of things just never get faced.
Sure.
Because there's this incredibly unpleasant thing that at a certain point it becomes clear you can't face. And then it sort of explains to me to some degree why other things that if you faced them, you could solve them, have never gotten faced. So anyway, but it was pretty horrendous. And, you know, and like the computer guy won't return my phone calls. And, you know, and the guy who does like the grant management doesn't return my phone. You know, yeah, I just treated like garbage. And, you know, so... But you know, on the other hand, my personal life is great. My husband's here, happy. We like Madison. I have a kid. She's in school. She likes school. And it's wonderful. If you have a family, everything's convenient. There's lots to do. It's friendly. It's safe. It's what, you know. So, you know, and then you just sort of, you know, and you manage. And then you find the people who you like. And then you ignore the people you don't like. And, you, and again, as a theorist, I don't have to get as much of the infrastructure to work as some other people. And then you just sort of manage. Okay. So anyway, so then you might ask, well, how is it that I'm chair?
Yes, that was going to be my question.
So after my second year, is that right? After my second year, it was time to sort of do the canvas for the chair. And so Lou Brooks, who's this condensed matter guy up there, and Lou and I had sort of, well, never mind. Okay, so what happened was that I had sort of a difficult relationship at first with him, because he's one of these guys who seems like a total stuffed shirt. And then it dawned on me, what would happen is he'd be bringing something up, and I would say something like incredibly cynical, and he'd start to scowl, you know. And I thought, you know, all right. But then, sort of secondhand, it turns out that Lou is friends with Alex Nagel, and Alex Nagel is brother of Sid Nagel, and Sid Nagel is from Chicago. And so I was talking to Sid, and Sid said, no, Lou likes you, you know. So I'm like, what? I don't get it. Like, you know. But then one day we were talking about something, and I said something really cynical, and then he started to scowl. I said, you're just mad because you were thinking that. And I said it out loud. And then he looks really guilty. I mean, it's a thing, you know, we were, you know, always like had this, like, you know, it's like, you thought you were the most cynical person around, and you're not, you know? Anyway, and after that, everything's fine. So Lou comes to me, says, well, you know, who do you think should be the next chair? You know, and so I say, well, so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so-and-so, and I think these are the people who would be the best. This is one by you. And I said, well, I'm not worried, because being chair is no great prize. Well, I'm not worried. I said, like, since the day I walked in the door, I've done nothing but complain. And, you know, and it's just, I just can't imagine the people who want me to be the chair, because I just go around and tell them how it's fucked up around here. So he goes away. He comes back, he said, no, people want you to be chair. And so I'm like, come on. And I said, no, okay. So, you know, because I was pretty straightforward that I thought that the place doesn't really function. And so so I thought about it. And here's the trade-off from what I can see. Is that there I was, you know, I come in, I complain, I say, we should do this and this and this, and this is fucked up, and that's fucked up, and this is fucked up, and that's fucked up, in those words.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't agree to try to change it, then I'm not allowed to complain. I could complain, but again, I wouldn't have that self-righteousness.
Right.
You know, of, you know, and so I'd say, well, you know, I'm giving up 3 years of my life doing bullshit for the right to complain for 20. I'm like, well, okay, that's a fair trade. And so that's, you know, so I said, well, all right. And so I deferred for a year because I had sort of, you know, another thing. And so Don did one more year, and there was the building. And so Don was stuck doing the building. And having seen how bad this building was, it was sort of like, that was a very good choice. But anyway, so then there was a year, I was sort of chair luck for a year, and then I became chair. But now, so basically it was because, you know, I think people realized that there was some need for change. So we'll see what happens. So last year we did a lot of recruiting. So the dean is, every time he sees me, he scowls, because what happened was, so we had 5 people leave, not this past academic year, but the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 3 people leave last year, so we were down 8 faculty. And what happened, and then there had been some retirements before them. And so what had happened was that we made, I think, not this past year, but the year before, we made 6 offers. And only 2 of the people came. And so, but we were down like a lot of faculty.
Yeah.
And, you know, because there had been sort of retirements, but there was a big club, but nonetheless, we were down, you know, quite a few faculty.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was we were authorized to hire 2, but then we had a couple spousal situations. And then what I did is I said, we're going to do full court press. And we came up with, you know, sort of 7 candidates. But then you sort of argue, well, 7 is, you know, you need 2. We have 8 more people who are 65 or older. And the point was that due to the sort of the spousal issues and various sort of things where we had made written commitments as part of retention offers to hire staff, that sort of the people, if they made us go down to 5, which is really the right number for offers for us to be making, if we went down to 5, the 2 best guys would be the guys who wouldn't make offers to. And I know it was just really clear, you know, they came in, they were fabulous, but, you know, you looked at them, you know, and you can just tell when you read these things that these are, you know, and these are experimentalists and very hard to land experimentalists, mm-hmm. whatever. And so, you know, so I did this thing and I sold it to the dean and, you know, 7 offers went out.
Wow.
And then I got the starter packages and that was like another, you know, major trauma and whatever, and groveling and begging and selling and whatever. And this wasn't so out of line because, like, psychology got 6 offers this year, but I got 6 of these people to come. And what had happened was that Reader had been offering, you know, more than 10% below market for the salary. Oh. Yeah, he just hadn't kept up with salaries,
mm-hmm.
and so he was just lowballing all the offers. So anybody who had an offer anywhere else didn't come.
Sure.
So anyway, it turns out if you make people competitive offers, you're more likely to get them. That's just what we learned. But you know, but the point was that we had this sort of rate at which people showed up,
mm-hmm.
and these were competitive things where most of the people actually had offers at other places, and I got them all. There's one guy who's still outstanding. He's actually supposed to show up here at 11 o'clock, And I had written him off, but I actually think he's coming too. I think we're getting everybody. Anyway, but poor Gary Sandifer, he's the dean. Yeah. You know, he wasn't banking on this. And so he's out like $2-3 million that he doesn't have. But we need to do it. I mean, in the sense, but it was like we didn't think we were going to get it all this year. But this is it. We're done hiring. My term of chair, I will. That's a major accomplishment. But it was really a lot. And the thing is, in some ways, you know, everybody feels very good about the guys. And good. You know, I think that what happened was that, you know, there are these internal politics of the department, of the different groups and whatever. And you know, really what happens is that if you do it all at once and you find really good people in all the sub areas. And again, a lot of the stuff was sort of mandated from things that the previous chair had done. So Reeder had made these commitments, and you know, and so the commitments that he had made, we lived up to. And you know, there's not, you know, and I think that it was completely decent, but not exceptional. But then we did these two other offers that were basically just the best on the market that we could get, and that had actually not been done in this department ever. Not filling the position, but going for the best, you know, sure. Just something that, you know. And there's a very good argument for both guys about why, like, this is a great place for them and they'll do really well here, and, you know. And that was how we were able to sell it to the dean.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is, like, these usual guys who keep coming back to the trough, it's like, oh, we can't hire because we're full, but, you know, it changes the balance of the department in a way that I think is really good. Mm-hmm. So that's my main accomplishment as chair. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, a lot of, I did like various hardball things, and I sort of, I won't say bamboozled, I mean, because, you know, I did it all completely on the up and up, but there was one guy where, you know, the whole thing was sort of going to rise or fall on this big machine called a stepper. And it's to do semiconductor fabrication. His work is on superconducting quantum computing stuff, but that involves very heavy-duty lithography, and the stepper is a way to sort of align the lithography when you're doing a process which involves many steps, you know, many processing steps.
Mm-hmm.
You need a large area, and so the stepper enables you to get good positional control over a large area, which is what he needs. And turns out that we didn't have one. And, you know, and I've talked to people in the meantime. Of course, I didn't know what a stepper was because, as you know, I'm not an expert malice. I didn't know what a stepper was, and I actually, you know, sort of got the stepper without knowing what it was. But turns out that doesn't matter because, you know, when you're dealing with deans, they only care about, you know, money. So what happened, though, is that, you know, but we were doing this negotiation, and it became clear that, you know, he really needs a stepper. He really needed it on campus. We said, well, but they have one in Ann Arbor. And it's like, well, no. If I have to go to Ann Arbor to get a stepper, I can't come. And he had another offer, and he wanted to come here, though. It turns out his wife, you know, was in Madison for a while, and okay. Yeah. And that's the thing, if you're dealing with someone who really wants to come, you're like, oh, yeah. So it turns out, though, that this guy, Franco Serena, who's in electrical engineering, had gotten Intel to donate a stepper to the university. And when Intel donated the stepper, they were $1.2 million off their taxes. Okay, so I don't know how much the machine costs. It was a manufacturing stepper, right? And then when they built the new fab line, they get a yet bigger stepper. And so then they have the old stepper that they're not using, and so they donate them to universities and take the write-off, okay? And the write-off that they took was $1.2 million, okay? But you still need, like, infrastructure to run the stepper. Because, you know, everyone, apparently, if you know anything, you know that a stepper is an important piece of equipment to have. It's a high-end piece of equipment, but still, I mean, if you claim to be a state of the art university, you should have one.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I was talking to one guy, I mean, very famous guy, prize winner, whatever, and I was like, do you have a stepper? And he's like, well, no, I decided I don't need a stepper. But they have like five steppers on he's at Illinois, and they've got lots of steppers. It's just, I don't want one in my lab, he says, you know, but that's not the same as not having a stepper in the state.
Oh, right.
All right, so basically, it turns out that they donated this machine, but it involves, it had to be transported and set up, and also it runs on 5-inch wafers, unless it was 8-inch, either 5 or 8, not that it matters. And when you're doing research, you're working on smaller samples, and so you needed to sort of retrofit it so it could handle things smaller than the 8-inch wafers. So the estimate was that would be $200,000 to do that. But then also, the clean room over in engineering would need to be finished. they did a certain amount, and then because of budget, they didn't finish it. And they're, oh, we need to get HEPA filters, whatever. But that just to, you know, there's like a room in the clean room that is unfinished that the stripper would go in. Okay. And anyway, it's been sitting out in the warehouse in Oregon for 5 years, unless it's 7 years. Oh, but for a long time. Okay. And so the university has the stripper sitting in a warehouse in Oregon, and they're paying to, just paying to store it a few $1,000 a year because nobody has ever gotten the, the wherewithal to bring the stepper onto campus. So anyway, Mark Erickson, who's a guy in the department who's sort of actually like the point person of the recruiting, sort of tells me all of this, whatever. And so, and we're like, we're this close to getting the guy. If we can get the stepper onto the campus, he's coming. I mean, yeah. We're completely convinced he's coming. So we had to go over to engineering and we talked to the dean. And so, and we have some gift funds that are earmarked to condensed matter, which are the Herb funds. So this is Ray Herb and his wife gave some money to help foster condensed matter research, and there was some money in that account. So so I talked to people in the department, and I talked to the guy who's sort of managing the fund. And so after this, I go into Kaczynski, who's the associate dean, and the deadline was coming. He had like 5 more days to answer, and I, and it became clear the whole thing hinged on this. So I went into Kaczynski, there were other people there, and I said, we will pay $100,000 from these good funds. We will pay $100,000 to help bring the stepper to campus if you say yes today.
Wow.
That was like my best moment. Because
no
it was
kidding.
This thing, because basically everybody going and groveling to the dean, whatever. Sure. Like, the money is on the table until 5 o'clock today. And he's like, well, whatever. I said, because look, we look like schmucks. Because if the holdup is at our end, and we had to give them an extension because of a holdup at our end, we look sort of, I don't want to do that. And there's no reason for it, because the thing's been sitting in the warehouse. And again, I don't remember if it was 2019, but for years, for 5 years, it's been sitting in a warehouse. And either you want it in the warehouse, and if not, and if you decide you don't want it, if you don't want the stepper, let me know, and I'll take the stepper. What am I going to do with the stepper? But never mind. He said yes at the same time. And so he got a yes like around noon, and 5 o'clock the guy accepted. And so that to me was like the highlight. Anyway, so that's what I did as chair. And so now we're going to try to get the things running, and we're leaning on the computer guys to, trying to get organized. And so that's what I'm doing.
Good
and
for
so,
you.
There you go. All right.
Okay. So I know you're not teaching. When you're chair, you don't have to teach, right?
Well, you teach one semester. And what happened was last year I did a real teaching one semester, and I almost died. Yeah. It was during the recruiting season, and I was teaching, a big course, and I was like dying. And so this coming year, I'm sort of teaching, but it's like bogus. I'm teaching with someone, and the other person's doing most of it, and But
do you enjoy teaching?
I wish I was better at it, and I think it is valuable, but I'm not like a great teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is that it's just the constant, I'm like one of these people that if I can prepare and whatever, I can do a really, I can do something great on a one-off deal, but the day in, day out of teaching for me is a challenge. Mm-hmm. But it's very useful, but I'm not great at it, and I don't say, I get to teach today. I mean, the teaching, though, I mean, the lecturing and dealing with students is fine, but the exams and the grades and whatever. So, but it's not onerous, and it's part of the job. Mm-hmm. But I guess if I were a better person, I would just explain how I loved it, and it's.
I hear that. But now, what about you don't have a lab for your research? But
right.
do you have the opportunity to work with individual graduate students?
Yeah. So, but they're doing calculation. Usually, the graduate students do computer work.
Okay.
But actually, right now I'm sharing because when you're chair, there are just times when you're just off.
Sure.
What I mean? And where you're just busy and you just don't have time to really focus as much as you should. So right now I'm sharing a graduate student with an experimentalist. And that's actually really great because the experimentalist travels a lot. And so between the two of us, there's usually someone for her to talk to. And and actually the project is going great guns, and it's very interesting, and you know, and sort of she it takes a very special graduate student to sort of, I think, deal well with a thing when there's sort of two professors with different points of view who aren't always. It's sort of fun.
Yeah.
The negotiating is, I mean, you know, again, it's interesting because you get into science and, you know, and it was true that the reason I was attracted to science is because I thought I wouldn't have to deal with people, and it was exactly like Casablanca and the waters, you know, where, but it turns out that I actually sort of enjoy
the That's
people
great.
Part. Yeah. I actually loved going into Kaczynski and doing that. Yeah. That was like really fun.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. No, I could see the guy was like, really take it. But you know, and again, it was just this thing of there's no reason why it has to take a long time.
Well, and I'm sure he's not used to having somebody come in every day and say, here's $100,000.
Well, that was the thing. It was the fact, you know, that was the thing we're thinking, well, can we do it? And you say, well, we shouldn't have to give him $100,000. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something the College of Engineering should have done. But it does get their attention. And it was this thing where, from the point of view also of the donor, you know, to say, well, this is what your money do.
Yeah.
You know, I
absolutely.
Mean, you know, and again, you may say it shouldn't have been necessary, but it, you know, but it, we never would have gotten anywhere, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. because it's just much easier to say no than to say yes.
Right.
You know, to say, we'll do it later. Because you're not saying no, you're just saying, well, when the budget looks better, we'll do it, you know, but then to have like half of the cost, half of the, this one-time cost taken care of.
Sure.
I mean, got his attention. So it was fun. But again, we discussed it up front, you know, and that was the question, do you sort of, this is the thing about negotiating. Do you do a thing where, you know, you just sort of say, okay, this is the thing, and you can say yes or no, or do you do a thing where you sort of hold stuff in reserve? Mm-hmm. And this question of, you know, how to handle that. And also because I don't actually have any authority, and the dean has the authority, whatever, there's the good cop, bad cop aspect.
Yeah.
You know, but how do you do it where you get the deal together? Or, you know, and that part of it where you're sort of strategizing.
Yeah.
And figuring out how you're gonna extract the most you can, given the constraints the system puts on you. I mean, is sort of fun. That kind of, particularly like when you get a call an hour later and you got a yes.
Right. Exactly.
But you know, I'm not sure that was the right thing to do. But it took care of it.
It worked.
Yeah. Right. And so, anyway, so
talk
back
about
to student,
your research,
right? Yeah.
Your student and research.
Yeah. So my research is sort of broad, and so that sort of has upsides and downsides. So I've worked in a lot of different fields, and so I know a lot of people, and I sort of have a lot of different interests, and sort of my area is. Over my whole career, you can put everything, I think, under the rubric of, quote, complex systems, which in physics actually is not a particularly well-defined term. But again, I mean, I work in solid states, so condensed matter is sort of solids and liquids, and there's some exotic phases of things like liquid crystals and stuff like that. But you can think of it as, you know, solids and liquids. And so one of the things I focused on a lot are systems that are not in thermal equilibrium. And so, you know, thermodynamics is sort of like, you know, there are the things that, you know, that materials do if you wait long enough, and they're equilibrated. But then there are things that, like, when you're driving them, and if they're conductors, you're putting electric fields on them, or you can be putting, you know, actually heat gradients, you can be heating up one side, but I've done a lot with fields, or you can be putting, you know, stresses on, you can be driving them with forces and things like that. And so then the thing about thermal equilibrium is it's a state where we have some understanding of how to compute the properties of matter that is in thermal equilibrium, and our understanding of things that are not in thermal equilibrium is much poorer. So this project with the student, the one I'm jointly supervising, is actually interesting on how shells grow. Okay, and they're a real mystery because, so this is nacre, which, you know, it's like abalone shell, which is mm-hmm. When it comes to actual, like what it is, it's some animal, but it has a shell.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about shells is that they're made out of calcium carbonate, and there are different structures, and this one's called aragonite. But if you just had a crystal of aragonite, it is very brittle, okay? And what happens is the shell has aragonite crystals and interspersed with proteins, basically. So it's a matrix, but the matrix is made of protein. And the shell is much tougher and stronger than the components. And we don't know exactly how to do that. So if you do man-made composites or, you know, artificially manufactured composites to be more gender neutral, there is no composite that is manufactured that has that property of being stronger than the constituents. You know, so you like, so composites that are made are like concrete. And, you know, in concrete, as you know, is brittle and cracks, and you know, you can't have, you know, I mean, you know, it's just much less resistant to cracking than these bio minerals are. And so that's why they're interesting to study. And there's sort of various levels on which you can study them, and one is sort of a descriptive level, or not descriptive, but, well, first of all, descriptive of like what the structure actually is, and then knowing what the structure actually is, and then we can go back and sort of try to construct models of, you know, how are they growing? What's the mechanism by which they grow? But then there's also this design principle of what makes them stronger, you know, what is it that leads to this high toughness and strength, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful problem, okay? And so with Pupin Stasia, who's another professor in the department, she does these experiments using, I'm trying to come up with a simple way of explaining it. It's spectrophotomicroscopy, but that doesn't tell you anything. So what it is that they shine, it's basically looking at X-ray absorption of soft X-rays and looking at spatially localized. And what that does is it's sort of local information about the local chemical composition of the material. Okay, so that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Is you know, it's sort of telling you about local chemistry, and it's a great technique because, you know, there are other ways to get like local structural information, but local chemical it gives you this local chemical information. Mm-hmm. Now this problem actually is sort of interesting, and what we're working on now is sort of, we really do want to correlate the chemical information and the structural information, and that's what, you know, that's going to be the next step of what we're doing. But what we found is that the chemical information that you get from the spectroscopy actually tells you something about the structure. There's a signature of changes of crystal orientation that we weren't expecting, and we don't know exactly what the origin is. So there's a theoretical question of, you know, what's the origin of the contrast that we see in this technique? And our latest result, which is the one where I say, oh, we're really getting somewhere, is this thing that it's not uniform through the shell, but only in a certain part of where it's growing is sort of where the contrast is greatest. And so there's something structural about that part. There's something about the growth in that part that leads to this contrast. And so it means that the crystallites are not homogeneous. You know, I should go up the shell. So I guess on the tape it doesn't matter. But this is sort of this picture of you're going through the shell. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, various layers. And anyway, and so there's this experimental thing of, you know, just we have a new result. The result that we had contrast was a surprise, and we wrote a paper on that. But then we have a lead on sort of the origin of the contrast, and that's going to, because it's not uniform, it's telling us something special about the growth. Mm-hmm. And again, if you know something about the growth, then again, the hope is again to get the design principle out that says, oh, this is how you get the really strong material. So that's a wonderful project, and it's what happened was that we thought we had better control of the experiment at the beginning than we did. And so we thought we had a sort of a straightforward theoretical calculation to do, but then we tried to do it, we realized that, you know, so it's actually gone back and forth more, mm-hmm. and Rebecca, the student, has been, you know, very good about, you know, well, we've been changing directions and doing stuff and whatever, but, you know, we can point to progress, and so we can feel good about that. So that's the one student who I have really actively working. And then I myself am working on a project which is, it's an outgrowth of the work I've been doing with the quantum computing group. And so that's sort of been one of the main themes since I've come to Wisconsin. So a quantum computer is a computer that sort of fundamentally exploits the odd quantum properties of nature. This thing about, you know, I'm trying to sort of say things in a basic kind of way. So in classical mechanics, if you have a particle, you know where it is. And in quantum mechanics, actually, you don't. And if you measured it, what the theory tells you is if you measure it, it might be here, or it might be there, and it might be here, and there's some probability that every time, if you do the same preparation to measure, every time you do it, you know the probability it'll be in a certain region. But, you know, exactly the same wave function, when you measure the particle, it could be in different places. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's sort of this thing of, it's sort of like parallelism, where it could be here, it could be here. And so one way of thinking about it, which isn't exactly correct, but is correct enough for these purposes, is that it's sort of like in parallel, the particle sampling all these different things. And so it's sort of like this, what people call it is quantum parallelism. It's as if you can do many computations at the same time. But the point is, when you measure it, you only measure one result. And so it's not like it's just all the things in parallel, but there are limitations on what you can do with that parallelism because of the limitations of quantum, of measurement of mm-hmm. quantum systems. And so there are sort of two issues. One is, what can you do with a quantum computer? And there have been a couple examples of problems that you know appear to be solvable much faster on quantum computers than classical computers. And then the other question is, can you build one? Okay, and there are a couple groups here about, you know, well, what do you need to build it and what's a good architecture and whatever. And so it's a great field, and we've been working on both ends. There's some guys in computer science. Bob Joint and I are collaborating with some guys in computer science on the more theory end of what can you do, and then Mark Erickson is leading an effort on can you build one. There's also an
Now, do you need outside funding to do your?
Well, I need little outside funding. So mm-hmm. I have a little funding from the NSF for theory. Mm-hmm. And then we have a little funding from, I think it's from the NSF, for the quantum computing theory. And then also I think now it's the NSA. It used to be the Army Research Office, but I think the funding switched to the National Security Agency is funding the quantum computing, mm-hmm. the experimental effort. But the rule of thumb is that experimentalists need much more money than theorists do. Mm-hmm. So, and again, I work on a very small scale. So there are people with big operations, and I'm not one of them. When I was in Chicago, at some point, I had 4 students, and I almost died. So, so I think of like 1 or 2 is the right number mm-hmm. for me.
Do you enjoy the writing aspects of your job and the publishing aspects?
Yeah, I mean, the thing I do best is give talks. I mean, it was sort of funny because, you know, if I could do it where I only had to give talks, that would be the best because mm-hmm. I do better orally than I do written, but the writing is a really critical part of getting it all straight.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have to work with your student on that to help her learn how to write?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, typically what you do is you make them go and do something, and then you go and rewrite. But that's also a nice thing when you've got another senior person, because then you've got more people to kick around the writing with. And so, you know, because again, if I were like a great writer, it would be different. But I'm not a great writer, and I find that having more people to kick it around with
mm-hmm.
helps a lot.
Would you talk about the culture for women on this campus? Is it easy? Well, first of all, is it easy to meet other people that you can coordinate with? Is it easy to meet other women who in the sciences?
Well, that's weird because there's a faculty women in science
Wisely, is it Wisely or is it something else?
No, Linda Spark does it. I think she gets money from the dean.
Okay.
And so I go to that, and so you sort of see people, but no, I mean that is a problem on campus where there's like lots of stuff on campus that it's not so easy to get plugged in.
Yeah.
And it's all done really on the basis of personal relationships. Also, I mean, one way where I meet more people than you might imagine is, you know, just through the child care aspect of things.
Oh.
You know, so, you know, just...
Sure.
You know, and so, but again, sort of in terms of my collaborations, well, Poopoo was in the department, and... it just sort of worked out. There was a student, and she had been interested in talking to both of us, and Poopoo kept saying, oh, we should do something, and, you know. But actually, I think having a student has been very helpful. And then the quantum computing, I sort of, when I first started, I solicited there and mm-hmm. started going to the meetings. I think that it's weird because, how do I say this? It's a funny campus. Right, because there's sort of all these things of, well, so for instance, yeah, all right. So for instance, like, wisely, from my own personal point of view, this is politically extremely incorrect. It's completely useless. You know, they have this thing, and they have all the stuff that they're supposedly doing, and it was when they first got the grant, there was a woman named Brenda Dingus who was in the physics department, who came the year before I did, and then ended up leaving. And she was frustrated by many of the things that frustrated me, but, you know, I ended up in this sort of funny path of, you know, anyway, here I am. But Brenda and I, you know, I liked Brenda, and she was, but she never really liked it here. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, when I came, I hated it too, so it didn't matter. So why is he gets this, whatever it is, big grant, $5 million grant, and it's like for women in science, and it's not targeted for entering, it's supposed to be people, established people, and, you know, established women in science, and supposed to help them in their careers, and you know, and I went to, they had a couple open houses, or meetings, or whatever, and I went, and whatever, and, you know, I'm talking to Brenda, and we were like, you know, this is great, and, you know, and there aren't that many, you know, and, yeah, there aren't that many women in the hard sciences, because, again, mm-hmm. it wasn't geared to biology so much, right? Mm-hmm. It was based in engineering, and, you know, and you're just saying, well, how many women, senior women, are we talking about, okay? And so we're like, well, this is great, okay? So Brenda and I, like, sit down, and we discuss, and we come up with, like, I don't know, and Brenda was very good at this. I'm not so good at this. Brenda, you know, like, five or six or seven, some of that order, things that we'd say, well, these would be things that would really help us. And was it just, well, we're not interested in any of that stuff. Hmm. I mean, they were like, well, we'll do workshops on how to be a chair. And it's like, but what if you don't want to be a chair? You know, I mean, you know, like how to get in the administration. Well, what if you don't want to get in administration? And, you know, it'd be things of like, well, we'd have things of, you know, here would be like supplements for women postdocs, and that way people would hire women postdocs, and, you know, whatever. But she came up with a bunch of like sort of creative things of, you know, of leveraging. It wasn't just like, you know, feeding at the trough. I mean, they were, and just, well, we're not interested in any of that. You know, and I realize that by the time you pay for Jen, Jen Sheridan, who sort of runs the thing, and then you pay summer salary to all the PIs. I mean, I realize that it's not very much money because you paid all the summer salary, but then these surveys are expensive. And I realize, you know, so by the time it's all done, there's no money to do anything. And I'm like, well, here it is. It's as if it's helping me, but it's completely useless. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but I had to go to the NSF and explain what a great program it is. But, you know, I'm not stupid, and I did. I said, oh, it's wonderful, and it has impact, and blah, 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 whatever. I mean, you know, because, look, I'm not going to sabotage them. Sure. But, you know, but it's completely useless. Or this other thing that Bob Matthew runs, the CERTL. You know, it's this thing where you constantly get these things. Well, you do this and this and this and this for CERTL. And then as chair, there are these things where we're trying to do things, we're trying to develop new things, and blah, blah, blah. And we said, well, we want to have this thing, and we want to, you know, take our physics courses that the biologists take and you know, revamp them, make them better, but I'll do some development. Oh, well, you get the money, and then you can take the people and send them to our courses. Well, what the fuck good is this? I mean, you know, and it's like, you know, so what I find is that there's sort of like a lot of lip service given. On the other hand, the spousal hire program, I was hired through the spousal hire program. I mean, you know, that was a provost, whatever. But the fact is that, you know, I wouldn't be here. And it's like, well, to the extent that I'm worth having or whatever, that was good for the institution, there was something that the institution did that made it so that I could come, you mm-hmm. know, because, you know, without the spousal hire program, I wouldn't be here. Because, again, when I just applied, they threw it in the trash because they just did. Because, you know, that's the way the physics department was. And spousal hire program, right? You had to explain to your dean why you weren't playing ball. You know, and there was no reason they could explain why they weren't playing ball on my application. Right. So, anyway. So then, I don't know. And, you know, and from the point of view of the department, you know, again, there's these things where I wish I could do things better, and you wish there was sort of more community, and then, you know, it has to be attainable, it has to be mm-hmm. feasible.
Sure.
You know, so that's sort of the other frustration, is just, you know, what's feasible.
Yeah.
You know? So I have mixed feelings, yeah. You know, because, you know, I hope that, you know, in 5 years people say, oh, this is great, and, you know, there's, you know, this was a good thing for the department, and these good things happen. But I sort of find that these sort of large, great fanfare efforts when you actually try to get them where the thing with Brenda maybe is ambiguous, okay, because Brenda and I were trying to come up with things that were good for us, because we were under the mistaken notion that, helping us was the point, okay? Mm-hmm. And it was clear it wasn't. But this thing about here we are and we're trying to do things to, make the education for, however many hundred biology majors a year better, and then you just sort of get this bullshit. What can I say? So there's just a lot of bullshit. That was also the point of the plaque, right? And the guy gets up in public, and then there's nothing. I mean, there's just a lot of that kind of stuff on the campus. But you do what you can, and what can I say?
Yeah.
And
well, let's go off campus for a minute.
Yeah.
You talked about earlier that you enjoy giving talks, and you must be involved in professional organizations in your field.
Sure.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's not particularly interesting, because, as a woman...
But is it important?
I don't know if it's important. I mean, it's part of what you do. How do I want to say this?
Is it necessary?
You ask hard questions.
Oh, I don't... I'm
well,
sorry.
Let me give you an example. I mean, some of it's sort of educational.
Mm-hmm.
And because there is this thing of, it's just like in the department where there's just a certain amount of shit that needs to be done, just stuff to keep things running. And again, there's a game of like hide the weenie where, you can get someone else to do it, well, so much the better. But if nobody does it, then the whole place sort of collapses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of true professionally to some degree. And so, and sort of what things are good things and not so good things or, worthwhile things, you don't know until you've done them. So, like, one thing I did was I was on the board of trustees of the Gordon Conferences. And, and it's just like I have one of these funny personalities that they're people who like me. And, then they find me entertaining and, I have an unusual point of view, which so the point is that I don't just say the same old shit, and so there's this question, if you find it valuable, even if you don't agree with what I say or believe it or whatever, but if it stimulates you to do something slightly different than you would have done otherwise that you feel would be better, then, mm-hmm. And so that actually can be very valuable in that kind of situation, mm-hmm. So I get asked to do a fair amount of this stuff, and partly it's for that reason, and I realize, you don't have to agree with me, but if you're stimulated to end up with a better result, then...
Sure.
Okay. So... and so one was the Gordon Conferences, and that was, and I'd say, well, sort of scientifically, and again, this idea that, you're sort of good versus not so good, and, the fact that they're, trying to do something sensible and whatever, I'm not sure, some other person, it's not so clear that you needed me at some level that I could point to. The only thing I did is it turned out that I had a completely incompetent lawyer. And I fired the lawyer. And, because everyone else in my house, they would go fishing with a lawyer or whatever. And, whatever. But I'm just like, but it became clear that the lawyer was, utterly incompetent. And someone had to fire him. And, that was my job. I fired the lawyer. But then there are other things, just sort of in discussing and this thing that if you believe conferences have value, which I think there's sort of this, just think about the issue of, like, what's the future? What are the areas that are hot and where are things going and stuff like that? I mean, that it's fun to think about. But then this question of, well, what's the value? I don't know. And then the other thing I did was, I was the chair of Division of Condensed Matter Physics of the American Physical Society. And again, it was very educational, sort of in a different way. But the one thing I did do, which I can really point to that would never happen without me, is that, so this past March, we had the big condensed matter meeting, and it was in Baltimore, and the guy who had been chair before me had said, oh, we really should do lobbying in Washington and make the case for science, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, he was past chair, and it was up to me to make it happen, and it really wasn't clear how to make it happen, and then through various, being sort of a pain in the ass, and we did it. And
well, that's extremely important.
Well, and it turned out the American Physical Society staff is completely incompetent. Completely incompetent. And the guy who's supposed to do congressional liaison is completely incompetent and a total shithead and a liar. So, yeah, I mean, it was sort of interesting because, you know, they were sabotaging it, and then, you know, I get this phone call from the president of the APS and saying, well, we want you to cancel, and I'm just like, you know, and then I just sort of went off, and I'm like, you know, I'm not doing this for my health. I did it because, you know, the high ups at DOE and NSF say that if you want to have impact, you have to do this. Mm-hmm. This is what you have to do. And I'm doing it because they said this is what you have to do to have an impact, not because I'm doing it because I want to do it, because it's easier not to do it than to do it. And the fact that this guy says that, you know, well, we can't do it because we don't have time because we have these other things to do, well, who is deciding what is this guy's top priority, okay? And so I'm doing, and the guy just, whoop, whoop, and you know, so fine, so we did. And it went off, and it was, everybody who went agrees that it was worth doing. And again, it was just this thing where it's, you know, and again, if you take that sort of hard-ass, impervious, you, because, you know, again, I wouldn't be in physics today if I didn't have a certain imperviousness to me. And, you know, that if I'm absolutely convinced that this is the right thing to do and you get enough impact, then the fact that someone is, you know, just saying, no, I don't want you to do this, and, you know, doing personal attacks and whatever, you have, you know, at some point, you know, that I am no longer susceptible to mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And so that was the thing where I could point to and say, just this idea that the physicists also have to, you know, just sort of try to make the case about why it's important to society right. to do this kind of work. So that was something I can point to and say, well, that was worthwhile. But again, a lot of people got annoyed because, you know, I was like ranting and raving and screaming at this guy. What can you do? Yeah. You know. So, but it's all right. And, you know, and certainly, and then, you know, and I have various outside honors, and I think that helps internally because they have
about those. Yeah. Just name some of them that you're most proud of.
Well, the one I just got, which I'm very, very proud of, is I was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences.
Oh my!
Which is, you know, quite a good honor.
Yes.
And no, it's this thing because, you know, sort of locally, because nobody knows anything around here. And so it's this thing where, you know, and I look, you know, and so one of the things that I find sort of annoying is that I don't have a chair. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I look at this and basically, you know, so I have some guy in the department, blah, 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 and I, you know, and so I went through, and I'm the only person who's been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences that I found who doesn't have a chair.
Oh.
So.
You think that'll change?
I don't know. We'll find out. Yeah. You know, but they have no way of knowing otherwise. I mean, that's the thing, because there's no internal way to sort of assess. Mm-hmm. And again, in my business, it's not like I'm going to bring in, you know, like a $1 trillion grant and then say, oh, it must be good. Look at that grant. You know, it's just not going to happen. But this is something where I think, you know, again, that internally it will help a lot. Okay. And certainly internally in the department, the politics of the department are that, you know, there are people who, you know, would be pushing me around, but because I have this honor and they don't, they can't push me around to the same degree.
Yeah.
So it's been very useful.
I'll bet.
Yeah. But anyway, so then that was very handy because it was while it was content, because I had other honors which weren't as good, but, you know, I had honors before coming, but, you know, but the one that you get while you're here, and again, that they don't have, is very helpful.
Sure.
So that's been, you know, but that was actually sort of, and again, it's sort of amazing at some level, but there you go.
Now, let's end this by, if you would talk about what your life is like away from the physics department. What do you do for fun? How do you balance your life? How do you stay healthy and energetic?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, but with the kid, I mean, you know, she's my daughter's 7. And so there's still the thing where you're, you know, you're sort of working on your hours and you got to be there. And there's just a lot
What's
of like...
What's her name?
Deborah. Yeah, a lot of logistics. So you're here, and it's sort of like, you know, and the summer is sort of interesting because she's doing like a camp, and you have to be at the bus at 4:30, and then I'm trying to work out with these other moms where I know the kids, and, you know, work out a schedule, and, you know, so there's a lot of that, and sort of a lot of like hanging, because when you have, you know, and that's the thing, if you work all day and you've got a kid, you really, on your weekend, you're really very family oriented. You know, mm-hmm. we see people, and, you know, we have cousins. It turns out, I didn't know this, but we have cousins in town and they have a kid who's 6 months older than Deborah.
Oh, that's
is. And
nice.
So it's very nice. And, you know, so, but it's not a very, you know, interesting thing. And we go and I do things and, you know, and she's sort of, seven's actually a pretty fun age.
Now, do you get to travel a lot in your job?
Well, this past spring, I that was one of the downsides. Is my traveling, I think, will be less, because I think this thing of it is interesting that as long as people are asking you to go places, then you don't want to go, because traveling's a pain in the ass. But then if no one's asking you, then no one loves you. Okay, so that's sure. the thing. The traveling itself is not so interesting. And in fact, this summer we did family vacation, and it was like the whole family. It was like, I went with my in-laws, and we went on this trip to China. And they were, and you know, and I did all the logistics of this trip and getting it all organized and things like this. And one thing is, you should arrange to give some physics talks. You can write it off your taxes and blah, blah, blah. But the fact is, whenever you do a thing where you've got your family there and you've got sort of professional obligations, wherever you are, you think you should be at the other place. And it's, you know, and I just, you know, it's like I decided, let's just do a family thing, whatever. Because whenever I've done that where there's been work, but it sounds like a fun place and we should all go, I mean, it's always a disaster.
Yeah.
So, and again, it's not like a disaster, but it's stressful. It's stressful because, mm-hmm. you know, at the conference, you should be hanging out, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's your family and your husband stuck in, stuck holding the bag. Mm-hmm. And that part, I've never really gotten to. Yeah.
What's your husband's name?
Robert Blank.
And he's in the medical school?
He's in endocrinology.
He's in, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, now, does he like Madison?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. It's sort of interesting, you know.
Do you like Madison?
The town is great. I mean, particularly if you have kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I grew up in, you know, Johnstown is, walk stairs when I'm there, but I don't exercise as much as I should, and I'm constantly getting yelled at by my doctor.
Well, I'm done with my questions.
Okay, all right, so I hope that was acceptable.
It was excellent, and I really appreciate it. Thank you very
yeah.
much.
Yeah, no, and again, it's sort of odd because I'm not like a Wisconsin, you know, I sort of came, I'm transplanted
here. No,
that's good.
Good. We want these stories too.
All right. Well, and we'll see what happens. I'm actually curious to see what everybody comes and whatever. You know, we'll see what happens. And,